The Enduring Importance of the First Amendment. Most of us take our freedom of speech, religion, and protest for granted thanks to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Yet, when the Founding Fathers crafted it, there was no way they could have imagined the impact of the internet, social media, trolls spreading hate speech, or so many other modern-day issues. Yet, for the past 230 years, the First Amendment has endured as the cornerstone of democracy through wars and cultural challenges, including the release of the Pentagon Papers 50 years ago. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we find out about Maine's own First Amendment Museum, and we'll learn more about Maine native Elijah Parrish Lovejoy, an anti-slavery and free press warrior who died fighting for his beliefs. Maine Calling is next. But first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution establishes that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Today, we are going to discuss how those words apply to current events and learn about Maine's First Amendment Museum. Joining me, Christian Coates. He is CEO of the Maine First Amendment Museum. Hassan Jeffries is with us. He's a professor of history at The Ohio State University. And Ken Ellingwood is a Maine native, a former longtime correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and author of the new book, First to Fall, Elijah Lovejoy's Fight for a Free Press in the Age of Slavery. We'd love to have you take part. We'd love to hear what the First Amendment means to you. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram now, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today for what I'm sure is going to be a bit of a mind-blowing conversation. But Christian Coates, I want to start with you. And a lot of what we're reading about right now because of the 50th anniversary of the Pentagon Papers has to do with the First Amendment and the freedom of the press. But I want to sort of make this even broader. There are people who are in no way involved with the media, who are in no way involved with activism, who still, all of us, the First Amendment affects our lives every day, every week of the year. Bring us back to the basics. What do we do today that we would not be doing if not for the First Amendment?
That's a great question, Jennifer. First, let me say thank you so much for having me on today. And it's been great to meet you and Ken, and always good to be here with my friend Hassan. I wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about the First Amendment Museum, because that's exactly what we're hoping to do. The First Amendment Museum is a fledgling concept museum that's located in Guy Gannett's house, which is next to the governor's mansion here in Augusta, Maine. If you've driven down State Street, you've probably passed the big Mediterranean Revival house with the red slate roof. That's us. If you're not from Maine, you might not know Guy Gannett or Gannett Communications, but Guy Gannett was the founder of a big communications firm, which was a family news empire that existed through most of the 20th century. It included the Portland Press Herald, the Kennebec Journal, the Morning Sentinel, WGAN Radio, WGME TV. And the house passed through multiple owners. And when its last owners vacated in 2010, Guy Gannett's granddaughters, Jeannie Gannett and Terry Hopkins Gannett, decided it would be a great idea to create a First Amendment museum, not a museum about their grandfather or about their family's business, but a museum that inspires people to exercise their rights, to live their freedoms. Because a successful democracy requires an engaged and educated citizenry. We have a lot of restoration work to do here to make this house into the national museum we envision. But when it's complete, there'll be permanent and rotating exhibit spaces, AV components, maker spaces, we'll host events and field trips, everything you would expect from a brand new museum. You know, Maine gets 38 million tourists a year. maybe not last year, but in normal years, we get 38 million tourists a year. And there are over 100,000 school children within an hour's drive of Augusta, as well as most of the population of the state of Maine. So we think we have a pretty good audience to appeal to. So what do we do on a daily basis that your initial question that what are our, what, how do we exercise our First Amendment rights on a daily basis? It happens in so many ways. I mean, from something as simple as sitting around the kitchen table and talking about politics, to looking at political cartoons, watching Saturday Night Live. You know, maybe we don't go to, not all of us go to protests, but we certainly can if we want to. Having those conversations with our friends and families, engaging in that conversation with your weird uncle at Thanksgiving, right? Those are all First Amendment rights that we exercise quite regularly.
Thank you, Christian. Hassan Jeffries, I want to turn to you. Since 1791, since the First Amendment became part of the Constitution, it has been linked to social justice movements. Walk us through a bit of the history, the significant moments that, you know, setting aside the founding fathers who wrote the thing, let's talk about what it has meant since that time in 230 years.
Well, it's been critical to the pursuit of equality, to giving meaning, a full meaning, to the words of the framers of the Constitution, the founders of this nation. African Americans in particular have used the First Amendment to petition, to pursue their full civil rights, civil liberties in American society. You know, African Americans from, you know, David Walker, you know, writing his appeal to the formerly enslaved who are engaged in documenting their experiences in slavery, writing their slave narratives, Frederick Douglass and those who are, you know, engaged in the work of publishing newspapers, Freedom's Journal in New York and the North Star and the like, and on through and beyond. Through the era of Reconstruction and redemption, African-Americans engaged in the scholarly work. W. Du Bois at the turn of the century saying, look, we got to speak truth to this. And then engage in, and very often it's the work of not only educators, but then also journalists. And, you know, at a certain point, W.B. Du Bois, you know, that amazing Renaissance scholar says, you know, this truth telling through academia ain't working. And then he goes with the NAACP and serves as the editor of the Crisis magazine. He says, I got to speak truth in a different way and directed sometimes at different audiences. And it continues, you know, World War II, Black journalists during World War II are really on the front lines of holding America accountable for the double V of victory abroad against Nazism and fascism and victory at home against Jim Crow and segregation and racism. And then, of course, as we move through the civil rights era, we see the ways in which African Americans are speaking a fundamental truth, not just in newspapers and the press, but gathering in public through protests and march, through peaceably assembling, and also through some nonviolent civil disruption. And so so African Americans in particular, among other groups certainly, who have been fighting for equality and justice, have been drawn to the First Amendment. It's what's unique about this nation. All the flaws, right? It created this window through which people could redress grievances. And that's critically important. And so to understand the way it has played out is also important for understanding the way change has occurred. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it only bends towards justice when people are able to exercise those First Amendment rights to exert the force necessary to bend it in that direction.
It protects the exercise of conscience.
It does. And the right to dissent. That's what's so critically important, because the exercise of conscience is fine if everybody agreed with what their conscience said, right? But it's when those who disagree, their conscience leads them to disagree with the status quo, that's where that First Amendment becomes so critical, because it provides space, an ideal setting space for people to exert that.
Ken Ellingwood, bringing you into the conversation, your new book, Elijah Lovejoy, In the Fight for a Free Press in the Age of Slavery. I think many people in Maine, especially people who are in some way connected with Colby College, have heard about Elijah Lovejoy because there's a big press freedom award given in his name every year at the school, but maybe don't know much about him. You are a Maine native. Elijah Lovejoy is a Maine native, but he did not make his name here in Maine. He went west to the frontier. Tell us about Elijah Lovejoy and why his story is so important in this conversation about the First Amendment and about the freedom of the press.
Sure. Thanks, first of all, Jennifer, for inviting me to come on today. Elijah Lovejoy was born in Maine. He was the son of a Congregationalist minister, and his mother was also quite devout. As well. So he grew up in a, quite a religious household in Albion in central Maine. He was a great student and a pretty talented writer. He graduated first in his class at Waterville College, which is today Colby College in Waterville. But his story really plays out in what we now call the Midwest, which was in his day in the 1820s, was the West. It was the frontier. And like a lot of young men of the time in the East, he went west to, you know, find his fortune. He was, as I said, a talented writer and thought he might make a living with words, and he did that. He became a newspaper editor without really any training. In those days, you didn't need a lot of professional training to become a journalist or even edit a newspaper. In St. Louis, which is in the state of Missouri, which, as we know from history class, was a slave state after the Missouri Compromise of 1820. So the environment in which he became a newspaper editor was a pro-slavery environment. He later went back east for religious training and became a minister. And then he combined those two roles, minister and editor, and returned to St. Louis to run a religious newspaper, a weekly called the St. Louis Observer. Now, this is where his story becomes interesting and relevant to us today, because he used that newspaper, that little weekly religious newspaper, to begin to criticize the institution of chattel slavery. And this is taboo. This is really pushing the limits in a slave state of what can be said. And in some ways, we should consider Elijah Lovejoy, who is largely a footnote to history for most of our country, we should consider him perhaps the first real hero of the First Amendment. He was part of a movement in the 1830s to raise Americans' consciousnesses about slavery and the evils of enslaving, at that time, 2.5 million human beings. And he did so from the very heart of slavery country. He was immediately, he started quite gently, and then he became more militant, more ambitious in his writings, and more forceful. And he was essentially run out of St. Louis by city leaders who wanted him to stop writing about slavery, by mobs who threatened him and eventually attacked his office. And he went across the Mississippi River to Illinois, a free state ostensibly, where he would find out that the situation facing a person who wanted to criticize slavery was not much different on that side of the river as it had been in Missouri, a slavery state. He was criticized roundly by many of the elites in Alton, Illinois. He was set upon by mobs. His office was attacked. He had three separate presses destroyed on different occasions. A home in which he was staying was ransacked. It was attacked by a mob, stormed essentially. And ultimately, Lovejoy would be killed by a pro-slavery mob in defense of his fourth printing press. And so we really ought to consider Lovejoy and his insistence on his right to publish as an early test of the First Amendment, and as a real hero of the free press, because he was operating in a time, and I'm talking now about the 1830s, during which, yeah, the First Amendment was written on paper, but it hadn't really been tested in any courts. There was no real proof that the First Amendment provided the protections it was said to in real life, on the street, if you will. And Lovejoy tested that. He believed that Americans had the right to publish freely. And because he believed that Americans had the right to publish freely, he did so. He published freely. And he paid the ultimate price for that in the end. But in the process, really modernized our nation's conception of what a free press is. A lot of people were outraged, infuriated, horrified at the killing of an editor, especially across the North. There was widespread outrage. And he, Lovejoy, that is, really raised the consensus. He helped produce a consensus that the First Amendment means that we can publish freely, even when those around us don't want to hear what we have to say.
Mm. We're talking about the First Amendment on Maine Calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Christian Coates, I know you wanted to add to what Hassan Jeffries had said earlier about the role of the First Amendment in social justice movements here in the United States.
I did. Now I want to add to what Ken said, too. I've got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. No, I think, you know, what Ken was saying about Lovejoy being one of the first heroes of the First Amendment is right on. I mean, he's really, you know, a martyr to the First Amendment, and maybe the first martyr to the First Amendment. I've got to give you a little bit of flack, Ken. I think the first hero to the First Amendment's got to be James Madison, the guy who wrote the thing, right? A lot of people will say that Madison's work drafting the First Amendment was more important than his work drafting the federal constitution that we still operate under today. And those 45 words are really pretty important. I think it's important for our listeners to know why the First Amendment's so important, right? Because the constitution does a great job of telling us how the government works. It empowers the government to do different things, but it doesn't tell us how we go about changing the government. The Bill of Rights tells the government what it can't do. It limits the government's power. But it's the First Amendment to the Constitution, the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights, that tells us how we go about changing our society, right? If you look at the preamble, if the goal statement for the Constitution is to create a more perfect union, then looking at the First Amendment through the lens of the African-American struggle for civil rights and social justice is the perfect, you know, vehicle to do that through, because it shows that struggle to create a more perfect union. And it lays out, the First Amendment lays out in five easy steps, you know, five simple steps, how we go about doing that. We have the right to think. We have the right to believe. The freedom of religion is really the freedom of conscience, right? We have the right to believe in whatever we want to. We have the right to speak about that. We have the right to disseminate those thoughts through the press, like Lovejoy did. We have the right to assemble in favor of those ideas peaceably. And we have the right to petition our government to change our government in favor of those ideas. So it's really this roadmap of how we go about bending the moral arc of the universe that Hassan was talking about. And it's really a beautiful structure for us to do that. The flip side is that people can also use those five freedoms to prevent change.
So, Christian, I'm going to stop you there because I have to go to a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of the current issues we're facing. I want to talk about hate speech. I want to talk about social media and trolls and the First Amendment. Well, we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from University Credit Union, who ask, how do you see you when providing financial options designed to help you live life on your terms? And Options, a program of the Maine Office of Behavioral Health, connecting Mainers to treatment, recovery, and harm reduction resources, details at knowyouroptions.me. and CAPE Integrative Health, committed to working with Medicare patients to treat chronic lower back pain with acupuncture. Learn more at capeintegrativehealth.com.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Sameen Nosrat, star of the television series Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, talks to Jessica B. Harris, the preeminent authority on the culinary culture of the African diaspora. Netflix has just made a documentary series based on Harris's book, High on the Hog. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
And you can hear that City Arts and Lectures program this afternoon at 2 o'clock. From bookshops to banks, cookware to home repair, a wide variety of businesses and organizations throughout Maine support this service. They understand the value of public radio and want to support it, and they want to reach you, the public radio audience. If your business or organization is interested in learning more, visit mainepublic.org and click on support and connect your business with our audience. Or call Dionysia Gaddis at 800-884-1717. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about the First Amendment and its relevance today. Our guests are Hassan Jeffries, who is a professor of history at The Ohio State University, Ken Ellingwood, a Maine native, a former correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and author of First to Fall, Elijah Lovejoy's Fight for a Free Press in the Age of Slavery. And Christian Coates is CEO of Maine's First Amendment Museum. Share your comments and questions via a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or call us at 1-800-399-3566. And we will get to those audience questions in just a moment. But first, Hassan, I want to turn to you and I want to bring this into the modern day, because there's so much going on right now that there is no way the founding fathers could have foreseen. And you know, I'm thinking about social media and its role for good and bad, good in enabling people to more easily organize, bad in that it provides a pathway for hate speech and trolls. Let's talk about hate speech. What is your view of what the First Amendment protects and doesn't protect?
Well, a full confession, I'm an ACLU person. And so, mm-hmm. you know,
but isn't there a debate even within the ACLU?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, there is a line that is not fixed. And it's a fine line between protected speech and terrorist speech, right? I mean, at what point does someone's right to share an idea, no matter how unpopular it is, move beyond just the realm of ideas to the realm of provocation? And that's where that line becomes very difficult. And it's a case by case. I mean, right there in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the ACLU was wrestling with this, you know, does the Klan, you know, have a right to rally? And you know, yes, right, unpopular ideas. But if you are using your so-called your right to free speech as subterfuge to actually engage in terrorist behavior, actually engage in violence, then I think you give up that right. In other words, that's what we have been seeing of late. People who have been using hate speech, not just to share unpopular ideas, but to rally, to motivate as a call to do violence and harm. And that is different. And that, in my interpretation of many, is not actually protected. That's the, you know, crying fire in a crowded movie theater. If it leads directly and purposefully and intentionally to harm, then it is not protected.
Ken Ellingwood, we're having this conversation right as media outlets throughout the country are marking the 50th anniversary of the Pentagon Papers. And for those who don't know what the Pentagon Papers are, it was a secret history that was written about the Vietnam War, published by the New York Times 50 years ago, that really exposed the lies the government was telling us. But even that, Ken, and I'm asking you this question because you've had a lifetime as a journalist, there is some debate about government secrets and what is okay to publish and what's not okay to publish. And I'm wondering, in your career, if you've ever faced a First Amendment question that you've grappled with, struggled with yourself?
Well, I mean, the Pentagon Papers case really, established, and I know that there are nuances in the opinions of the justices in that case 50 years ago, established essentially that newspapers and other media can publish freely without the government restraining their publication beforehand. In the case of the New York Times, it was the government's attempt to block publication of the Pentagon Papers, of these secret documents. I would like to speak from the point of view of a working journalist. The First Amendment is our oxygen. It's what gives us the constitutional protection, but also the constitutional duty to report freely. We have, as a news media institution, we have a vital and, I would say, sacred role in a democracy in providing freely information that people should know. And it starts little. I mean, I've covered city hall meetings and town hall meetings where I had to stand up and object to a closed session, for example, when a school board wants to go into executive session to discuss topics in secret, essentially. And there are some cases where that's allowed under the law, and there are other cases where it's not. And sometimes, a young reporter standing by himself or herself has to stand up and say, no, you can't do that. In my career as a foreign correspondent, I've worked in places where there is a constitutional right to a free press, and yet reporters are greatly endangered with violence. I worked in Mexico covering the drug war there for 4.5 years. Now, Mexico has in its constitution the right to free speech and a free press. And yet it is one of the most dangerous places, or was at the time, for journalists to operate. That is because the rest of the understanding of a free press doesn't exist fully. There is government impunity, there's corruption, and there are rampant crime gangs running around with guns and acting with impunity. So in part, and I want to tie this back to the Lovejoy story a bit, in part what I find really remarkable about Lovejoy was that he was operating, as I mentioned before, in an era where we didn't really have court rulings to establish that the government can't do this or that, or the press is protected in this way and that way. It was a very young nation, and we didn't really know that, they didn't know at the time, what was the extent of press freedom, how far could you go? And many of the laws at the state level regulated the press. So from a point of view of a national protection for the press, it was really quite untested, and Lovejoy did a great service in pushing the limits of that. But it helped establish what I would call the kind of extra legal trappings of a free society. That is to say that society understood that a free press meant a press that could publish even unpopular opinions, even opinions that rankled people in the community. And I think subsequent rulings in the courts in the 20th century helped to expand that and establish the kind of understandings that we have as a robust democracy.
An email here from Dan Hassan. I'll throw this one to you. Dan writes, free speech, yes, but why do we have anonymous free speech? If someone has something they want to express, they should at least have to be willing to be identified with it.
I mean, that's a great question, and I think it's a fair question. But it doesn't necessarily, I mean, we look at the law, the Constitution doesn't say, you have a right to say what, from government interference, but you have to attach your name to it. I mean, that's something that we want, that we would like. And when we think, I think, Ken, going back to your point of the centrality of the press, you know, protecting the anonymity of sources has been so critically important. And just think of particularly when we think about free speech and the role of the press, the importance of sources and those who have gone to jail to protect sources. And so the question of, like, yes, it would be nice if we all knew and you required this. And especially when it gets to the internet, it gets a little dicey. People can hide behind anonymity. They can spew hate behind anonymity. And so perhaps, companies and social media can require that people, identify themselves. And perhaps that's the place for that kind of regulation. But I wouldn't want it to be a requirement made by the government to say that, yes, this applies, but you have to identify yourself in that way. I think that gets into dangerous territory.
Betsy on Twitter, and Christian, this is for you. Betsy writes, talking about First Amendment martyrs, what about Julian Assange? And on a totally different topic, get your guests to talk about the fact that social media giants, Facebook and Twitter, are the de facto censors of free speech at this point, and how bad an idea that is. So two big ones there, Christian. First of all, Julian Assange, not a U.S. citizen, but still at the center of discussions about government openness and transparency and secrets.
Julian Assange, not a person I've spent a lot of time studying. Ken might have more insight into that.
Okay, then with you, so Ken, you hold that thought, and with you, Christian, I'll move on to talking about social media giants. I mean, this brings up the topic of the First Amendment is freedom of the press. What defines the press, and what is a social, and where does social media fall in this spectrum in terms of what is protected?
That's right. Who is the press? Who counts as the press today? Anybody with a social media account, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, might be considered a member of the press because you're describing what's happening. Somebody with everybody in the world.
A blog or a podcast, yeah.
Right. And so the social media is going to be something that gets, we're going to have to figure out whether we're going to regulate it or not. And in fact, there's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now about a student who's kind of known as the Snapchat cheerleader who posted some things on her social media account about her school off school premises after school was over. And it's made its way to the Supreme Court. And I think Justice Clarence Thomas was talking about how the court is going to have to start weighing in on what is or isn't allowed on social media these days.
Ken, I'm going to turn to you for your thoughts on Julian Assange.
Well, I look at it from the point of view of a journalist. Julian Assange is not a journalist. He traffics in information or did at the time. For his own purposes. Those may be good, those may not be good. I don't take a position on that. But I'd rather talk about the role of journalism and the kind of worrisome trend I see in the blurring of the line of what is a journalist. I mean, journalism is first and foremost, it has been written, the art of verification, right? That's what we do. We don't just go out and write impressions. We don't just take what somebody says at face value and print it or air it on television or radio. Our job at its heart is verification. So if you're not verifying, if that's not part of your role, I don't really consider you to be a journalist. That's got to be it's a central part of what we do. It's what keeps us up at night. It's what makes our days very hectic and very, very difficult sometimes. It's what gives us gray hair. It's the rigor required in actually making sure that things that appear in the public view are true. And mistakes get made, absolutely. But I'm somewhat worried about the blurring of what is reliable journalism and what is just noise out there. And I think we have to do a much better job of teaching our children, for one thing, in the schools and outside of the schools, how to separate fact from fiction, how to separate real vetted information from noise, from disinformation, from conscious attempts actually to fool people, to lie to people. And I want to make another point about the state of journalism in this current era. We have just been through a presidency that was led by a man who called journalists enemies of the people, who denigrated the work of journalists as fake news, who set a tone for the country that journalism is somehow suspect and bad. And I will point out that during the January 6th mob insurrection at the Capitol, before that mob ever forcibly tore down those barricades and entered the Capitol, it attacked journalists. Members of the mob destroyed equipment, attacked journalists who were there to cover their rally, and it kind of goes back in my mind to the era of Lovejoy, where he faced violent mobs with really no protection from any authorities at a time when mobs could really run rampant and did in America in the 1830s. And so when I see the events of January 6th, I think very selfishly, perhaps parochially, about journalists in that and being victimized. But I worry about the overall tone that has been created in opposition to journalists and to create hostility to journalists. And I think that does not do good things for our society.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Coast Sea Vegetables, offering 8 species of organic wild seaweed from the North Atlantic. Learn more at seaveg.com. And Lee Toyota of Topsom, featuring the new lineup of 2021 Toyota hybrid electric cars and SUVs. LeeToyota.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. When did you learn about Juneteenth in school? Writer Clint Smith says, like most, he doesn't remember learning much about it.
I think generally with slavery, I think I got the hits, so to speak, which is to say I learned vaguely about Harriet Tubman, about Frederick Douglass.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now coming up at noon today. Have you subscribed to The 10? The 10 is Maine Public's free weekly e-newsletter, our curated look at 10 exceptional, thought-provoking, and compelling stories. These stories are not necessarily from the front page, but rather those that you may have missed during the week from Maine Public, NPR, PBS, the BBC, and more. To sign up or to check out past issues of The 10, please visit mainepublic.org.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Joining us today, Christian Coates, who is CEO of Maine's First Amendment Museum, Hassan Jeffries, a professor of history at Ohio State University, and Ken Ellingwood, author of First to Fall, Elijah Lovejoy's Fight for a Free Press in the Age of Slavery. Share your comments or questions at 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Chris, calling from Lewiston. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Good morning. So my question at the end of this is going to be, at what point does the freedom of speech become such a danger that allowing some of it outweighs the benefits that we generally derive from it? And so by way of background, the Canadian Charter of Freedoms specifically says that people have the freedom of thought and speech. So it's person-focused. The American Constitution says the government shall pass no law abridging the freedom of speech. So it says the government shall not do some stuff, although our Supreme Court has basically said, yeah, but under certain circumstances, that's allowed. And in light of almost having the most successful insurrection against American government in our history, as a result of the extraordinary amount of disinformation and propaganda being put out by one side versus the other, we came really close to having a real tragedy in this country because millions of Americans believe a bunch of stuff that is patently false, my family members included. You know, that some dead Venezuelan dictator got involved with, Cuba and China to overturn an election by flipping votes in electronic voting machines. Where does the freedom of speech become stoppable because we recognize that it's going to become very, very harmful?
Well, this is what we were talking about before, Hassan. Christian, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, you know, Chris, you brought up the Canadian Constitution and you brought up the U.S. Constitution, and I'll do you one in the middle. The Maine State Constitution says that every citizen may speak freely or may freely speak, write and publish sentiments on any subject, being responsible for the abuse of this liberty, right? So even by 1820, when Maine is writing their constitution, they're throwing in some caveats to unlimited free speech. But, you know, as a nation, we have a really liberal, probably, you know, if one of, if not the most liberal ideas of free speech in the world. It gets back to what Hassan was talking about earlier. And of course, the problem is the slippery slope of when you decide to let the government, you know, crack down on what they consider offensive speech. Where do you draw the line and who gets to make that call? And, you know, who's the party in power? You know, did you want our last president to make that call? Did you want the president before that to make that call? Can that call be changed every 4 years by executive order? So it's a slippery slope, and we've sort of relied on the free marketplace of ideas and the notion that truth will out and the best ideas will raise to the top. And will that always happen? It's a great question.
Chris, thanks for your question. An email here from Judith. I have served the victims of sexual violence and become interested in pioneering efforts to ban pornography because of the violence it encourages against the vulnerable. Ultimately, free speech won out. It's a difficult problem in the face of ongoing violence against the vulnerable. Thoughts, please. Hassan.
No, I'll weigh in a little bit. You know, when we think about the First Amendment and the way it's constructed, and I'm glad, I think Chris, the caller, had raised this in comparison to the Canadian Constitution, it's about what the government can't do, right? And so in that sense, there is a civic responsibility on the part of the citizenry to sort of decide what is acceptable, what is tolerable, and what is not. And I think we have to take that seriously. The question that is raised by, you know, is, you know, some speech just disagreeable or not, or is it actually promoting violence, is something that is important for us to recognize and acknowledge. And I also think it's something that society has to deal with. Now, we have a long track record of not dealing with it very well. That is, I understand that. But we have to also say, well, you know, do we trust, and Kristen, you just raised this wonderful point, of do we trust government to do it? And because government changes. And sometimes you got responsible folk, and then sometimes you have folk who are saying the press is the enemy of the people. I mean, that is real. And so I think that there's no simple answer there. But I do think the answer lies somewhere in the faith in the people. You know, it wasn't that long ago, I mean, the 19-teens, 1920s, where censor boards were universal and acceptable. Right? Like, this movie can't play here, this song can't be here. I mean, so we've moved away from that to open it up to sharing more ideas. Because when you begin to clamp down, you not only to limit those things that, you know, we think are harmful or disagreeable, but so much else gets trapped in that net. And that's the risk, and that's also the price, the cost that is asked to have this freedom.
We'll go to Rick calling from Berwick. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Listen, I was just wondering if your guests thought that Upton Sinclair's work, The Brass Check, had a place in this discussion and in a museum about the First Amendment. I don't know if they're familiar with it, but it's very relevant to the topic.
Kristen?
Not familiar with it. Looking it up right now.
Okay. Well,
it's a book that was used in the teaching of journalism a half a century or more ago. It's about 100 years old. Anyway, I'll listen to the discussion off the air.
Okay. I'll move on. We'll move on to Portland and Bill. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm loving this discussion. I went to Colby College and took many classes in the Lovejoy building, named after Elijah Paris Lovejoy. I took those lessons to heart. And against a lot of opposition, I spoke up and led the successful fight that shut down the main Yankee nuclear power plant 12 years early. And I have a prediction for one of the next issues to come up. We're just scratching the surface on the pharmaceutical industry. If you look at the mass shooters, you'll find that most of them were on Prozac and a couple were on Valium. And no one wants to talk about it. And it's an uphill battle. But the research I've been able to do on my own, every time I look up someone, you know, the Texas Tower shooter, the Mandalay Bay shooter, those were both
thanks for your call. I want to turn this back toward the First Amendment, though, in the protection of protest. Ken Ellingwood, Elijah Lovejoy was killed when there was a protest. So this whole question of the right of people to protest, and of course, the insurrection, some would argue, and some have argued, was a protest. Talk about the First Amendment and the right to protest, and what is protected and what is not protected, and what Lovejoy's story teaches us this many years later.
Well, I think what Lovejoy faced would clearly not be considered, according to subsequent Supreme Court rulings in the last century, would not have been considered protected speech. These were armed and drunken men who gathered by the dozens to forcibly ruin Lovejoy's printing press. He had ordered a fourth press to replace the one that had been destroyed only a month earlier. And he had taken it into a warehouse and assembled a bunch of his friends inside the warehouse to guard it. So you had this kind of a siege situation where Lovejoy and his friends are inside this warehouse with this printing press that he has decided he's going to protect with his life. And some of his close friends had decided they would do the same. One of them being the owner of the warehouse who had other property in there too. And you get this drunken mob outside with guns and blowing horns and vowing that they are going to get this press, you know, come hell or high water, and at the expense of life if necessary. So I think in that situation, what we had was an attack. You could call it a riot, certainly. Under no definition that I've ever seen could we call it a protest that would be, you know, that would be protected under common sense rules of, you know, of American life today. If you fast forward now to the, you know, to the insurrection in January, which I find just, you know, very disturbing in a journalistic sense from the point of view of journalists, you know, working there, but also some of the imagery that appeared at that event. I mean, there has been a T-shirt marketed that says "Tree Rope Journalist, Some Assembly Required." This is being sold on the internet. There was a group wearing a logo called "Murder the Media." So it's not as though these were people in all cases who just decided to take a stroll, you know, over to the Capitol and see what's shaken. They weren't just there to have, as some would say, a normal kind of a tour of the Capitol, a preposterous notion, right? They were there in some cases, and I'm focusing narrowly on the press here because it's my concern and the focus of this discussion. The tone that has been set of hostility to journalists with these kinds of inflammatory, provocative messages, I really fear that, you know, there will be a day when there will be violence, real, you know, serious violence directed against journalists. We're already seeing in some of the protests that occurred, you know, in Minneapolis and outside of Minneapolis, in protests against, you know, police killing of unarmed Black people, journalists were targeted by police with armed with, you know, non-lethal, quote unquote, rubber bullets and pepper spray and caustic agents. They were detained. Their identification cards were seized. They were treated like rioters. And it's outrageous. It should not happen in a democracy, and particularly in the case of the protest in recently outside of Minneapolis. It came after a judge's ruling saying, you know, don't do that. So I'm concerned about the overall climate that journalists face. I think it's become more dangerous. I think it's become potentially a very explosive situation, and the kind of images that I saw from the January 6th insurrection seemed to echo to me right back to the Lovejoy mobs.
We have just a little tiny bit of time left. And Hassan Jeffries, I want to ask you what you're watching right now in terms of what's making its way through the courts. What is important to determine what may define the future of how the First Amendment is interpreted in our country?
Well, we haven't quite seen court cases yet connected to it, but this wave of reactionary legislation that is working its way through state legislatures across the country, banning the teaching of so-called critical race theory, the interference in our public education from state legislators who are insisting that we ignore the most troubling aspects of our past, that those conversations, that history that intersects with race and racism doesn't have a place in the classroom. This is really troubling as an educator, but also as a person who believes in free speech of government. Certainly has the state level certainly has the right to sort of dictate and determine curriculum, but we're talking about passing fiction off as fact. And purposefully and intentionally miseducating. That is dangerous. It has a stifling effect on teachers in the classroom. And it has led, just in the same way as we have seen sort of Donald Trump's calling on or disparaging of the media, this same attitude, this same sort of energy disparaging teachers we've seen sort of, mobs of parents at school board meetings and the like saying, no, you can't teach this. And so even if the legislation isn't passed, you're still getting, this stifling effect where teachers are afraid of teaching the truth. And that worries me. And so there will be cases about that coming up.
Oh, boy. So much to talk about. Hassan Jeffries, thank you so much for being here today, a professor of history at The Ohio State University. Kristen Coates, also our guest, CEO of Maine's First Amendment Museum. And Ken Ellingwood, a Maine native and correspondent, former correspondent for the LA Times and author of a brand new book, First to Fall, about Elijah Lovejoy. Today's sound engineer, John Keimel. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.